How good does it get, SK?
Why not us, Charlie?
Today, live from the Pinecrest Inn, it's The Smiley Show. So long, everybody.
This is The Smiley Show.
All right, we are happy to be joined by Cam Young. Cam, after a couple of little delays here with my Riverside internet situation, we have finally made it here for the third time. So again, Cam, we are thankful for you to take the time to join us today. And I can tell, you know, just as a dad of two, how difficult and how challenging and how fun life can be during the holidays, especially during the off season. Just talk about your family, how much fun it's been to be at home during this off season, but also the craziness that I'm sure that ensued during this past holiday season.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, our house is always busy. We've got a 4-year-old, a 3-year-old, and an 18-month-old girl. The two older ones are boys, so they're certainly active. But yeah, I mean, the holidays is a great time. It's time where I feel like I can really try to step away from practicing a little bit and be just really present at home. So it's a lot of fun. I mean, they're with me all the time traveling, really. But you know, to be able to kind of work on my own schedule and really spend some good time at home has been great. You know, just watching them change and grow. And you know, every time you get to, like, you get back to Christmas and I think about what they were a year ago, and seeing how much they've grown up, and it's a lot of fun just watching them change and see just how their personalities kind of develop through those first 4 years.
Any fun Christmas presents that that Santa happened to bring that it maybe have brought even more craziness to the house?
he was pretty lazy this year, to be honest. They're still so little, they're just excited to rip the paper. And yeah, so we usually go with, like, they needed some new pajamas and some new clothes. Mm-hmm. We got them their own little suitcases that they can kind of roll around.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah, just some simple stuff. They really don't care. I mean, they're just excited to come out and see. Like, we got to the point, we built with their Legos, we built them like a little setup. It was very mediocre. But even something like that, they're just excited. Like, the elves built your Legos with you. So it was fun.
That's fun. Well, at least Santa didn't have to maybe build a trampoline at night. So that's good to hear.
No,
that.
No. I built two pedal bikes, but built is a strong word.
Hey, how did that go?
Snapped two things into place, and that was about it.
I had a bunch of friends sending me pictures of them building kitchens the night prior, and it was sure. You know, the sheet just was insane. You know, it looks like a textbook, and just the amount of pain that some fathers had go through that night can be a little challenging.
Yes, for we haven't gotten to the real complex stage where there's anything big involved, but we've built plenty of that kind of stuff over the last couple of years. it definitely is a pain, but it's worth it for, like, the hour that they
yes, 100%. Well, it sure is fun to be at home during the off season, spend time with family. And in most of these interviews, Cam, I always like to try to go back to not quite the beginning, but to where I feel like the most pivotal time was for this player. And for you, going back and looking at your career and seeing, you know, of course, you had all this success at Wake Forest. You had a great team there, Willie Z, and had a bunch of success. And so I was sitting there just kind of going through the calendar of, okay, he finishes 2019. I was like, oh man, that was right around COVID. And so I'm thinking, okay, how did your journey get impacted by COVID-19 and trying to get on the PGA Tour? And boy, oh boy, I did not realize that you were just right in the thick of it, man. You had Canadian tour status, but that whole tour got canceled.
Correct. Yeah. So Canadian Tour Q Spool, it was March 2020, and it was the same week as the Players. So it started on Tuesday. Final round was Friday, and Thursday was first round of the Players, and then it was canceled. They didn't play Friday, and that was our final round. And the way I understand it was nobody running that tournament was quite sure what to do. They hadn't, like, received orders to do anything. So we just played on Friday, and I ended up winning the tournament. So I earned full Canada status. And had I not eventually made my way onto the Korn Ferry Tour later that summer, I wouldn't have made a Canada start for almost 18 months after I got
Holy
my status there. So
moly.
Yeah, it ended up working out great. I mean, it probably saved me a year or two. Who knows?
It did. But, I mean, I just think about 18 months later, dude, you were, like, playing at the Tour Championship, like, in the Presidents Cup. Yeah. Like, so it was actually COVID-19.
5 years. Who knows?
Who knows? I mean, there's been so many great players, Cam, that of course have come out of college and that have been world beaters that have taken forever to get to the PGA Tour. Some guys never even made it to the PGA Tour. So your journey is super, super interesting. And I want you to tell me about that summer of Monday qualifying for Korn Ferry Tour events. Just tell people what Monday qualifying is all about and how frustrating and difficult that process is.
Yeah, it's not an easy road. I mean, like you said, there's so many talented players that just don't find their way out there. And I think it's one of those things that takes some good fortune and some good timing. And, you know, in my case, it just worked out that way. You know, I played Monday qualifiers most of that summer and got all the way to the last one. You know, it's one of those things. You go shoot 66 in the third group out of the day. And you're already out. Man,
I understand.
Yeah. I remember one in particular in, I think it was Briggs Ranch in Texas.
Yep.
And I think I shot 65, like the second group out, and there were already four 63s. So it was just one of you had no chance unless you shot 9, 10, 11 under.
Oh my God. Did you qualify for any before? We'll get to the one in Omaha, but before that, did you qualify for any other Mondays?
No, I had gotten through a US Open sectional, which is a kind of a different animal, but, really until then I hadn't played in any, you know, major professional event on a kind of a PGA Tour sanctioned tour. And, eventually got to Omaha, the last one of the season, the last Monday qualifier. And, I shot 8 under 64.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of immediately, I'm like, okay, well, that's not going to do it. Just based on my experience that summer, it just felt like, okay, I played well, but that didn't feel that hard. There's going to be five people that shoot 10. So I waited around all day. I sat in the parking lot for hours and finally, you know, started looking pretty good with a few groups left and got in. And it's actually my current caddy, Kyle. I called him because I had been joking with him all summer, you know, hey, if I get into something, will you caddy for me? And, of course, he said yes. You know, he was playing himself. And but I called him on Monday afternoon and said, hey, can you meet me in Omaha, Nebraska? And
oh,
said,
my sure, gosh.
So, caddy for me for a couple of weeks and, you know, strung together four really good tournaments and got myself conditional status or special temporary status, I suppose.
How many events do you think you played Monday qualifying? Do you think you played, you know, more than five during that time?
Yeah, I probably played high single digits. I probably played six or eight.
Okay. So can you run through just what those costs kind of looked like and just the operating cash that you had that summer to kind of play with? Because I had read that you were probably maybe you were planned out two more weeks before you're potentially writing letters to the membership at Sleepy Hollow trying to fundraise a little bit. I mean, you were right up against it, man.
I was out. Yeah. I was out of cash. It is expensive. I mean, the entry fees are expensive. Travel's expensive. Even if you're trying to do it cheaply, you know, I split hotel rooms with my college teammates. I found the cheapest flights I could for the most part. And, it just is expensive. And, you know, unless you've worked for a number of years, you know, not many people coming out of college have much money to their name. And, you know, I didn't have a job. I never worked. I practiced. So, you know, I didn't have much money. And thankfully, you know, we're very lucky. Sleepy Hollow was incredibly supportive of my father and of my career. And I don't think I would have even had to write a letter. There were already some people kind of lining up to help me out, which I'm incredibly grateful for looking back, and also grateful I never had to make that ask. Just because I feel like as soon as you start taking that on, there's just another layer of pressure that you don't want to have. And there's plenty of it on you already. And
totally
for me, that would have been, I think, difficult. So, to get in when I did and, you know, to never in that first, there were plenty of setbacks, but I never felt like I was going backwards. I wasn't, you know, from that point on, I wasn't running out of money. I wasn't, you know, struggling to keep a card. I was kind of fighting my way up. And I wasn't really, I never felt like my back was against the wall again after that. I played some terrible golf in between there and when I won in the spring, but it never felt like it did kind of the end of the Monday qualifying season.
Totally. And I think a lot of people forget too, is that that Corn Ferry season wasn't just a season. It was a wraparound season. It was basically double the amount of events where it made it even more challenging for a player like yourself who was playing, you know, a season behind basically. You got into the very end of the season in Omaha and you had four great weeks that give you that special temporary status. But all of a sudden you're looking at the points list and you're like, I have a lot of work to do to get a PGA Tour card. But I'm sure you were probably thinking, man, I just want to like keep my card for the following year. So when you get that first win, how nice was that to be like, all right, now we got to go chase this thing.
Right. Yeah. And no, I mean, that was a huge moment for me because I think I moved to 26th when I won that week,
which is crazy. So, you know,
you kind of all of a sudden you're like, okay, you know, I started with nothing. And then I honestly, I think, I don't know the number, but I missed a lot of cuts early that year. Probably
there were some, I definitely
9
saw
of 12 or something. Yeah, there were a lot. But yeah, it just kind of opened the door to a new possibility. I feel like it all of a sudden I had another new opportunity, and that was to get a PGA Tour card. So, you know, to do that at that time when I had kind of just enough time left in the season where it was then feasible to get into that top 25 and earn some status, it was, you know, just like I said, it takes some good fortune and some good timing. And for me, that was just as good as it could have gotten.
And of course, you win back-to-back weeks. You end up getting a PGA Tour card. Just, you know, playing a season and a quarter on the Korn Ferry Tour, did you find that your game wasn't quite as good on this tour with just the, you know, the shorter golf course? We just talked to Aldrich Potgieter last week about how challenging it sometimes is for longer players to feel like maybe their weapons are kind of diminished a little bit. Did you get a feeling and a sense of that too? Was it ever frustrating being on the Korn Ferry with that?
I would say a little bit. I mean, you just get a little different style of course, kind of like you said. I mean, there's, from what I remember, there's a lot more courses where there's trouble left and right. On the PGA Tour, you get not necessarily more wide open, but more rough and less penalty tricks.
Yeah.
And that was kind of where I struggled at that time was keeping it in play all the time. And so I think it does have some impact, but at the end of the day, you know, if you're going to be good enough to compete on the PGA Tour, you can figure out how to get it around somewhere you don't love. So I think it was, you know, one of those things where if I had to do it now, I think just mentally, I would be a lot better prepared to kind of adapt to that. And at the time it was just frustrating. It was like, why can't I? You know, I wish I just hit it 280 and straight, and I didn't. You know, I hit it 318 and all over the place. So it kind of took some fortune to line it up and have a good week. You know, and it shows in the results too. Like some of the places that I played well, like that second win, the Glen Club, is a lot less, you know, penalty strips. It's a lot more kind of fescue.
Is that the one in Chicago?
Rough. Yeah, Chicago.
Yeah, yeah. I played that one year. It's like Northwestern's golf course.
Yeah, it was a really cool spot. We played it in 35 degrees and pouring down rain, which was great. But so it does show. I think if you look back at the courses where I played poorly, it's pretty self-explanatory. It's, you know, I didn't know how to manage myself. But you know, it did end up working out, and
You get to the PGA Tour.
I'm thankful to be where I'm at now.
Yeah, you get to the PGA Tour, and man, do you ever go back and just look at that season and just look at your results and be like, man, life came at me so quickly that rookie season. Mm-hmm. I mean, how good a golf were you playing that rookie year? I mean, you had, I think it was up to like 7 top threes. You know, you were in contention to 2 major championships, being the PGA and then also the Open Championship. You had other runner-up finishes, you know, beginning of the year in the fall, that wraparound and Jackson going up against Sam Burns. And then the Genesis, which is one of the best, like, you know, PGA Tour events coming out as a rookie. Like, man, I get into this and get in contention there. Is that where it like kind of sparked the confidence, was leaving LA, or did you already kind of have it leaving Jackson?
I would say I definitely had some of it leaving Jackson. I really felt like I not necessarily should have won, but I was right there and had every chance to win. And to me, that was just kind of evidence that if I stuck to what I did and trusted that, I was at least going to put myself in position, you know, on a somewhat regular basis. I felt like, because I didn't feel like I did anything special that week. I just avoided some mistakes, you know, and played some good golf. It wasn't like I made everything in sight. It wasn't like I was, you know, doing anything crazy. It was good golf. And to me, you know, that's not necessarily one of the biggest events of the year, but you know, there's plenty of good players in the field and it's a good, solid, straightforward golf course. So sure. I felt like even though maybe it's not one of the fields that you would have said is an elite field, it still felt to me like if I could play that kind of golf on that golf course, I could do it a lot of places. And then, like you said, Riviera is huge. I mean, that's about as big of a stage as you get in a non-major. Ever since then, I've just loved it there. I think that it's just kind of was a perfect match. I was playing great. I like the golf course. And, you know, to hang around the lead for that long with Joaquin doing what he was doing that week.
It was a shootout that week, wasn't it?
It was ridiculous. He
like, well, I you shot like 62 one day, didn't you? You shot like, I think 62.
And I was four back. I don't even remember.
I remember
making the turn on Saturday. And Joaquin made two on number 10 to get to 21 under. And I didn't know what to say. Yeah. I mean, it was crazy.
A par 70, right?
Yes. I think maybe 71.
71.
Yep. So he got 16 under the first two rounds and then was 5 under 10.
Yeah.
Which is just kind of something you don't really do there. So, it is one of those. It's, you know, looking back, I played great and, you know, I haven't had a result as strong since then there. I think I've had a couple around 20th. But, I mean, it's just a place that I feel like I'm always going to have some kind of chance. I love it there, and I think it suits me pretty well.
And when I look at the rest of your rookie season and just winning in general, I think about this all the time. First off, like, to win golf tournaments, you have to be in contention, like, on the back nine, of course. And sometimes, like, you need a little bit of luck. Like, you need some guys to play poorly, and then you need a city to take advantage of other guys playing bad. Other days, it's like four guys are running and playing well, and you have to go and shoot 31 on the back nine.
Yeah.
I feel like when I look at your rookie season as a whole, I feel like you had moments where you kind of experienced it all. Like, you had days in which you played good enough to win golf tournaments and didn't win. And then you had other days where, like, you had opportunities to win and it just didn't quite work out for you down the stretch.
Yeah.
How frustrating was it after that season being like, man, I just, you know, I got in contention major championships and had this incredible season and make the tour championship, get invited to be on the President's Cup. But then you're like, I don't have any trophies in the cabinet. What the heck happened? Like, you know, it had to be so annoying.
Yeah, it's definitely some of both. I mean, you hate to look at it that way, but it's kind of an unavoidable feeling. You know, to have, it's exactly what I said. Someone asked me at the PGA Championship, you know, when are you going to win a tournament, basically? And I said, I don't know. I mean, I played okay today, and I'm sure one of these times I'll shoot 31 on the back nine, like you said, and win. And I went to the British Open, shot 31, and lost by one. So to someone that shot 30. So it's just one of those things. I mean, it does have to line up. It does take some fortune. And yes, it was frustrating in a sense, but it's the same frustration that I felt the first week or my second tournament, finishing second at Sanderson Farms. You know, I'm immediately frustrated that I didn't win. And then you take an hour and you're like, okay, I've pretty much kept my card, which is a major step. And I've also reshuffled myself to the top of the Korn Ferry category.
Yeah.
I'm going to get into Phoenix, Riviera, Arnold Palmer. As much as I would love to be a grouch about it and say, you know, why can't I win a golf tournament? At the same time, like, okay, I've made it to Tour Championship. I made President's Cup team. I'm in all the majors next year. I'm in all the tournaments that I want to play next year. So as much as I, you know, you want to kind of be frustrated in a sense.
Sure.
There was no sense in hanging on to that because I had done a lot of good for myself and, you know, set myself up for years to come of just being comfortable on the PGA Tour and knowing that I can play some good golf.
And on Sunday, you know, I think so often when players get in that situation, it's that playing golf while you're uncomfortable. So you got to experience not only that trying to win PGA Tour events, but also major championships and then also President's Cup, which oftentimes, you know, players that leave, whether it be the President's Cup or Ryder Cups, it serves as springboards to players because I think it just adds belief to the player, you know, being around that many other good players and then them mm-hmm. believing in you just instills even more confidence that you want to get back into that position to play for these teams. But also just heading into that next season, just playing with even more confidence. Mm-hmm. But I experienced a little bit of this getting off to a very hot start in my PGA Tour career. Everybody always said, man, you just don't need to change your expectations. Don't set them too high. And I never really felt like it affected me too much. But looking back, I probably had a little bit too much added pressure to myself mm-hmm. of having really high expectations. Did you struggle with that in your sophomore season on the PGA Tour at all? Just wanting to, you know, crave to get into that contention and win golf tournaments?
Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was necessarily unique to that year. I think it's something that I've probably struggled with since I was a kid. You know, I expect a lot of myself, the people around me. And mm-hmm. I think it's one of those things that does push you forward, but if it gets going the wrong way, it can do the opposite as well. So yes, I did struggle with that, but I don't think it's necessarily unique to that year. And I don't think it really explains kind of the downtick in golf. I think there's probably a bunch of reasons and maybe that played a part, but I really don't think that that's a kind of a unique feeling for me for that year. It's just something I've always had. I have very high expectations of myself now, you know, as I always have. And I think it's a strength in a lot of ways, but you have to learn to manage it like anything else.
Yeah. That's what I was going to ask is how have you been able to manage that, you know, over the last couple of years to not get too low and or get too down on yourself? That's something that I was my biggest critic. I got so frustrated with myself so often, and sometimes it would make me get in my own way. And so I'm just curious how you've been able to kind of manage that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a combination of things. For one, kind of, and not even actively managing the expectations, but you know, I had 2 years, my second and third years on tour, I would classify as mediocre.
Yeah.
You know, I made it to the BMW championship both times. I finished kind of mid-40s in FedEx. Mm-hmm. I had a chance to win here and there, but not like the first year. And I think having that experience kind of, and I said this after the Wyndham championship in an interview, was I started playing worse golf and I was much more grateful for the times that I was playing well. So I think taking those opportunities for granted probably doesn't help kind of on the expectation side. You know, if you get there and you're like, okay, this is, you know, it should feel business as usual, but this is what I expect every time.
Yeah.
I don't know if that helps, as opposed to, okay, you know, I'm 3 shots back on Sunday morning. Like, this is a great position to be in. I'm thankful that I've played the golf I have to get here, and I'm looking forward to trying my best today, you know? So yeah, I think it's a combination of that sentiment and then also kind of changing where my expectations lie. We've worked a lot on that over the course of this last year. In terms of just, you know, you could set expectations on, I expect to finish top 10 every week. Or you could say, I expect to execute my process to the best of my ability every shot, every day. Mm-hmm. And I think that second one is much more effective. And that's kind of what we've worked on, is trying to create processes, create belief in those processes, and just expect that I can do that, because that's in my control. I mean, you start getting angry and getting fast.
Yeah, totally.
That is under your control. You know, have a bite to eat, take a breath, and kind of go back to the process that you've put in place for yourself. So I've tried to change my outlook on that toward things I can control, which is not always execution and results. It's process and preparation. And if I can do that to the best of my ability, you know, the golf should be good. Maybe it won't be, but it should be. And you know, that seemed to play out over the second half of this last year.
Did you ever observe any other players that you were able to kind of take a little bit of something, whether it be that mindset and just being watching somebody just run their process time and time and again, and feeling like maybe that they never got too high or too low? Was there any other players that you felt like you're like, man, I need to just kind of get into a little bit more of how kind of how they run their routines?
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch that come to mind. I think Scottie Scheffler has something special about the mental side of the game, obviously physically as well. But, you know, you can't, I feel like you can't perform at that level and execute that highly no matter what your skill level, unless you are kind of special between the years. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, he's someone that I watch, and that's all it seems like he does to me. He doesn't, I don't feel like he's ever trying to do anything special. I don't feel like he's really ever trying to force anything. I just see him step up and try to make a good swing all the time. You know, he just
easier said than done, right?
He does. For sure. I mean, it's your head can get in the way. It's a powerful thing. But he seems to do that better than just about anybody to me. And I'm sure that that is a contributing factor to the reason to how he executes on such a regular basis.
It's an absolute superpower. And yeah, it feels like you said the mind is a powerful thing. And I could not agree more, because it's so easy for doubt to creep in, and it just comes in randomly. And you never know when it's going to come. Some days you have more of it, some days you have less. But it seems like certain, like players like Scotty, sometimes even guys like Xander, it feels like they deal with it way less than other people and are able to just throw it out. And internally, it looks like they're not dealing with as much as the other guys. But meanwhile, you know, other people are wired differently. And I certainly had my share of doubt that creeped in over time. But that is the thing that impresses me the most. I couldn't agree more about Scotty and in between the years, how it just seems like, how does he, could somebody just not like put a sign up just to like make him work out his mental game a little bit to make it a little harder?
From the outside looking in, it looks like he just presses the button and runs through his process and hits it to 4 feet. Like from, I mean, I wish that, I could take more from that. And that's kind of the goal. I mean, is for it to look like that and feel like that. But I just think he's probably better than anybody else at that right now, on top of having an extremely, extremely high level of skill and talent. I think that really is what it looks like. It looks like he's just running a program, and he doesn't seem to miss very often. So
and he's a player too that's improved his putting over time, to where now he's one of the better putters, it feels like. And when I looked at your stats over the last couple of years, if there was a place to nitpick during those years you would call mediocre, the stats that jumped out to me was the putting. Now when you go look at it as a whole, you had, you know, very positive weeks. It just felt like it was fairly inconsistent. Like you would have a pop week and then you'd have kind of two off. For you, like over those 2 years, what do you feel like you were working on in your processes to be able to get to a point in 2025 where you showed so much improvement? You know, sometimes things like, you know, it doesn't happen overnight sometimes. Like what were some of the keys for you to kind of get you over the hump to where consistency started to come?
Yeah, I think it's a matter of experimentation through those couple of years. You know, I tried basically every grip under the sun to get rid of, you know, any kind of like hesitation or, you know, anxiety over the ball. And I was able to do that. Like, you know, I putted claw and I never had any issues really. I just wasn't great. And I feel like I always came back to thinking that my best putting weeks were conventional. And so it just took me a couple of years to get through, you know, thinking that maybe I couldn't do that anymore, that I had to put claw, or I had to put cross-handed or whatever it was. And it just took some experimentation to get back to that. And then also get to a place mechanically where I didn't have the same feelings. And I also was comfortable doing what needed to happen to move the putter properly. So I don't think it was necessarily flipping a switch and all of a sudden I was a great putter this year. It was a lot of things I learned over the course of those 2 years. You know, we went through a period of trying to make aim point perfect. And, you know, I'm a bit kind of number oriented. I've always been decent at math and like that kind of thing. And I tried really hard to figure it out and try to make it exact, and I just couldn't. And looking back, I mean, it was, to me, such a ridiculous thing to try to do. I mean, you can't measure perfectly. You don't know exactly how far you are from the hole. It was kind of insane to try to actually go through and make it work.
Yeah.
And that was some of the struggles, you know, was in the process of trying to do that. And
so you're just thinking, you know, just thinking so much, like you're not really in that flow creative state. You're almost just very hands-on, like scientific almost.
I was trying to figure out a way that I could not misread a putt, you know, and it doesn't happen. So some of it is kind of abandoning that. Some of it is on the mental side, just becoming more accepting of what happens realizing that putting can be stupid. You can hit the best putt, you know, twice in a row, and one of them misses left, one of them misses right, and it's not because you hit a bad putt or you read it wrong. It just didn't go in. So some of it's that, and then some of it is just purely mechanical. I'm just mechanically better than I was.
And what were the mechanics? What were some of the changes that you guys worked on?
It's all set up, really.
Always is, right?
Yeah, it's pretty much
for good players. It always seems
pretty much
to be
where you put your head, and making sure that you're square. You know, it's nothing complicated. It is one of those things that takes time to make it comfortable. I think, and if you're not comfortable at putting on the golf course, you're thinking about mechanics and you're not thinking about rolling a ball at a target. Mm. And for me, it just took all that time to kind of accept what I already knew about the setup and take the time to make it work. Mm. So it was, you know, it's one of those things, like you said, about kind of having some performance anxiety. Like, you know, when I first started putting conventional, it was honestly the perfect storm. I started this past year at the Cognizant Classic. Mm-hmm. And first hole of the day, I started on 10. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a dogleg right, par 5. Mm-hmm. Hit it in the fairway. I think I hit the fairway. Anyway, I ended up just over the green to the back left pin. Chipped it like 4.5 feet by. And my first putt of the day is like uphill into the grain a little bit right to left, which for me is always perfect. Where I felt like I struggled. Yeah.
It's really?
That's the one that I... Yeah, that's the one I feel like I always hit too soft. Mm. And kind of just got up over it and was like, well, if it works here, I'm kind of good to go. And so I just kind of, I kept my head down. I didn't look and made a good putt. And that was, I feel like, the start of being able to really commit to what I did the rest of the year. So when I look back, you know, it shouldn't matter whether I made that putt or not, but looking back, I mean, that was a step for me. It was a big step in learning to trust what I thought was right.
Interesting.
And kind of refining that through the end of the year.
So for somebody that is listening to this, that struggle with their own, whether it's putting, chipping, ball striking, you know, what advice would you give that person about how they're able to kind of build in the confidence bucket, you know, with just a 4-footer that you remember back in March, you know,
yeah.
You wouldn't think it's much, but how are you able to build on that with more putts that you feel like, you know, can continue to give yourself confidence, but also, you know, not being negative about the ones you miss and thinking about it. Like, how do you flush it?
Yeah, that's the holy grail of putting in particular, I think, is understanding that you can do everything right and read it correctly and execute well, and it's just not up to you. You know, all that stuff is, but whether or not it actually goes in is not necessarily up to you. You know, on the short ones, it kind of is, but once you get outside of 6, 8, 10 feet, stuff just happens. So I think a lot of it starts just in practice, knowing that you're doing what you intend. And if you're able to kind of keep that mindset of, you know, hey, I prepared and I went through my process and executed as best I can, that's really all you can do. I mean, and it sounds so simple, but it's just the hardest thing to do because you just get sure so is. Wrapped up. You care so much about whether the results match what you feel like you did. But yeah, I mean, that's the holy grail of putting to me. It's just if you can know that your mechanics are where you want them to be and commit to executing the best you can, you have to let go of what happens. And I feel like I got better and better at that as the year went on.
Yeah.
And I think it does allow you to kind of enter a better state, because I remember, especially late in the year, I'd had some really good putting weeks, and I remember hitting some putts that I'd missed. That I would look at my caddy and just say, I hit such a good putt. Like I don't care where that went. Because I know that if I hit that putt again, you know, I'm going to read some of them correctly and some of them are going to go in. And, that was kind of where I feel like I made the jump from like, I've putted pretty well most of this year to like, hey, maybe I'm just good at this. You know, I can I can hit a good putt and be okay with missing it. And take some confidence into the next one, knowing that I've just executed a really good putt and I can do it again. So I think that's kind of the shift that has happened over the course of this year.
Well, it's such good advice. And as you go throughout this 2025 season, you started to kind of build throughout the summer until you got to that Wyndham Championship. And I thought it was interesting, you know, going back and reading the transcripts that week, I remember that there was some type of change, and I couldn't remember exactly what it was. And I'd read that you had switched to a different golf ball that Tuesday. Mm. So what did you find in this golf ball that kind of helped you, whether it be with your ball striking or something that, that you saw with your eye? You're like, okay, I can play my tight draw and everything's going to be, you know, whether it be hitting my numbers more with my irons. I just remember your par three play that particular week, which is stupid, man. You just made twos every time you got to those par threes.
Yeah, no, it was entirely a spin control, distance control thing. So for me, you know, I hit the ball pretty hard. I hit down it a lot. I do create a lot of spin.
How many degrees down do you hit on it?
I don't know. A lot. Probably like eight with a wedge.
Oh, really?
Nine.
Wow.
I don't really know. But it just is one of those things I've always struggled with. You know, I get a back pin on greens that aren't firm. What do? I've got to hit 9 iron from 135 yards to try to keep it back there. And making this switch, especially Sedgefield, is a lot of the greens are sloped violently back to front.
Mm-hmm.
It's not particularly firm. The greens are very fast. So it's kind of a perfect storm for me to struggle. But we made the switch, and I literally just watched the ball basically like plop where it was landing. You know, I could hit a gap wedge to a back pin and it would just stop there. It wouldn't rip back.
Wow. So it's a firmer golf ball is what you basically switched
into. It's not necessarily firmer. I don't know the science.
Okay. But you just, it wasn't ripping.
It feels correct. It wasn't spinning back. It wasn't, you know, and with that, the added benefit. So it basically is meant to, the peak of the flight, it turns back down as opposed to like peaking up. So it turns the last bit of up into forward. Which for me with the irons means I add a couple yards because I'm not wasting that forward energy on lift. And it means that where I was playing 15 yards of wind before, I was playing six.
Wow.
So it made a big difference for me in the wind. And then on top of that, not having to worry about some of those back to front slopes. It just made golf feel so easy. I mean, I definitely lose something in terms of being able to stop it. Because I don't necessarily hit it a mile in the air. I've always kind of been like a leaner. So I do think I lose some in ability to stop the golf ball quickly. But what I lose in that, I feel like I pick up in control so drastically. I mean, it was to a point, especially when I was hitting it pretty well there at the end of the year, where I wasn't necessarily concerned that I couldn't stop it because I would just land it 2 yards closer to the front of the green. Like that's really where golf just started to feel easy. So it's been a good switch. And I mean, you know, nothing is perfect, but it is a much improved, you know, thing for me. Just it makes life a lot easier.
You sound like you would be very challenging to fit. Like, I just feel like you've probably have, you know, just a lot of things going on there with hitting more down on it, being a high spin player. And, you know, we like to see certain things off of the tee too, you know, whether the ball is coming off too knuckly or too spinny and then managing that all the way into wedges. Like I can imagine that when you finally get a golf ball, it's like, oh, like I imagine the Wyndham, just like you said, felt so easy to you.
It was just all of a sudden 137 was just 137, and it wasn't, you know, is there wind? Is it going to hurt at 2 or 10? Is it going to spin back 5? You know, it just turned into, okay, I can just hit gap wedge.
Yeah.
And especially kind of at the time, you know, hitting basically everything right to left. I don't think I hit a fade the whole week. So you add that in and, you know, the wind is just not really touching it. And
totally.
There's a few shots I remember. Just it was just so much easier.
How nice was it to finally get that win and not to hear us say, you know, it's going to be eventually time. This guy's going to win on the PGA Tour. How refreshing is it that you never have to hear those words spoken again, dude? Because you know, it's always something that's asked to us as analysts. I'm like, it's going to come. It's going to come. But like, it's something that we always talk about because we know how talented you are. But it's got to be internally frustrating. Like, they just shut up and just let me get this win and I'll figure it out.
There were definitely times where I felt that way, but it's I mean it saves me a question per interview. It's a good one to not have to answer anymore.
That's great, man. And of course, like at that point after that Wyndham Championship, you know, heading in the middle of the summer, you know, you were definitely on the outside looking in on that Ryder Cup team, and the way you played that summer, I was like, man, he kind of seems like a guy you can't leave off the team. Then you win at the Wyndham Championship. Yeah. You have a great playoff run where you end up getting really close to the Tour Championship, I believe finishing fourth place. And still, you never really know. How tough was it, you know, waiting to get that call from Keegan, knowing how important it was for you to play for that Ryder Cup team? And then also, of course, I mean, it's Bethpage in New York, where you won the New York State Open as an amateur. So you just, I imagine just the anxiety waiting on that phone call was at an all-time high.
I mean, it's truly a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, in particular for me being from that area. You know, I'm never going to get that again. You know, I don't know when the next Ryder Cup could even possibly be in New York, but my guess is I will barely still be standing. So
you're going to be captaining.
I mean, it definitely was on my mind, and we kind of reevaluated after Augusta. I played some awful golf at the beginning of the year, and, you know, we just said, okay, where are we going? And my answer was the first tee at the Ryder Cup on Friday. And which I was, God knows where in the points, I was like 80th in the FedEx Cup probably by the end of April.
Long way to go.
Yeah. So, and I mean, genuinely felt like, why am I even thinking about that? I mean, things started looking up kind of the beginning of May. It really started then. I played well at the Truist, and then I actually played well at the PGA Championship as well. I just happened to be deathly ill. So kind of turned like a week that I felt like I was playing good into a 50th just because I could hardly keep my head off the ground. from there, I mean, I had a lot of good golf that I played. And then obviously kind of culminates in winning at Sedgefield in the Wyndham Championship. And, you know, I had spoken with Keegan about the Ryder Cup about a year prior to that, kind of as soon as he knew he was the captain. I sat with him for a while one day and just obviously expressed my desire to be on the team. And there was no real pretense of anything. I just said, you know, obviously this is a dream for me. It's New York and I want to make that team. I don't want you to have to pick me. but you know, win at the Wyndham Championship, and really all he said was, you know, congrats, I'm proud of you. But I got to see a lot more than that. And I was like, fair enough. Okay. So I feel like I was really grateful for that, even right away, because it just made it so clear to me what I needed to do.
Keep going.
And then, finished fifth at St. Jude, and literally said the exact same thing, which was, I was fine with. It's like, okay, I'm playing good. At least I know I have the opportunity. It's right here in front of me.
Yeah.
It's just up to me to play some big golf. And then, you know, then I made an eight or something, the last hole of the first round of the BMW Championship. And I was like, okay, maybe that was it there. And found my way back to 11th and then played great at East Lake. And like you said, I mean, there is some anxiety involved waiting for that call. But at that time, off of that little 4-week run that I just had, I was pretty at peace with whatever happened. You know, obviously I desperately wanted to be on the team, but I couldn't have asked much more of myself for those 4 weeks. You know, I would have loved to play a little bit better here and there, but all in all, if you had said that I was going to even have a chance to be in the question in April or in May, I would have told you were nuts. So I was just grateful to be in that position where my name was even in the hat, you know? So obviously it worked out great, and I'm extremely grateful to Keegan for giving me that opportunity. I know it's a difficult situation for him. He, you know, had by every means a good enough couple of years to be on that team himself. And I understand in some ways, I don't know exactly how everything was, but to some extent it feels like it could have been either me or him. And for him to give me that opportunity, you know, in my home state, is really special to me. And I'm extremely grateful to him for that.
Yeah, that's interesting. You talk about just being at peace after that great 4-week run. And people ask me all the time, Cam, like, what do you miss the most about professional golf? And it's like, well, you know, I miss competition. Of course, like, you make a lot of money, so it's nice to be able to provide for your family. But the thing I really miss the most is being able to set a goal, run through my processes, and then also go in and feel like I completed those challenges. Like I checked these boxes off, and regardless if I win or not, like this is why I do this. It's the active part of going to try to accomplish something you set out. So like for you to getting that call, it's like, hey, this is cherry on top. Now I'm at Bethpage. Yeah. It's like, that's why most athletes, they just love, if you don't like the process, like you're not going to be in what you do for a very long time.
Yeah. I think that's true. I mean, and those moments of peace are so few and far between, at least for me. Maybe I'm doing it wrong, but there's just not often that you kind of sit down and you're like, okay, you know, I've done what I can do, and you know, this is a good place to be.
Yeah.
So I just feel like those are rare, and I didn't have it at all after the Wyndham Championship. I mean, I would have loved to sit back and say, I didn't even like give my dad a hug until two mornings later. He was like, "Hey, what you did last week was pretty good." And I was like, "No."
Yeah, I almost forgot about really it. It's like about I keep it. Going.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I didn't have it at all for that because there were two more jobs at hand. I needed to get to East Lake to have any chance of making the Ryder Cup team. And those were the things that I had to do.
Yeah.
So I think after 4 weeks of just going through it and, you know, those weeks are difficult. There's obviously a lot at stake. It also happens to be really hot all four of those weeks. Dude. So it's a physical battle and
dying and to kind of, weeks.
Yeah, to get to Sunday night at East Lake. And my wife and I actually went to dinner, which is kind of a rare occurrence, but we went out and we just sat down and we're like,
I feel that
what a 4 weeks. And just, you know, just trying to take a second and be grateful for where we were and take a breath and, you know, got the call the next morning and, turned into one of the greatest professional weeks of my life.
Looking back, of course, you were the youngest player on this United States Ryder Cup team at 28, which kind of surprised me. I was like, wait, wasn't somebody else younger? But you're the youngest guy on the team. You had a 3-1-0 record, one of the best on the team, of course. And I was kind of interested to see how you emotionally were going to handle yourself that week because you're so mellow, like you never get high, never get too low, but then you get paired up with two firecrackers and JT and Bryson. Were you surprised at the emotion that came out of you, you know, when you're having these moments of winning holes that you surprise yourself? It's like, whoa, you almost scared yourself there with a little bit of an emotion.
Smiled, yes and no. I mean, I feel like, in individual competition, I've never had a putt to win something dramatically, you know? So I feel like I've never really had an opportunity for there to be that kind of emotion shown. And it's just the perfect storm for it. I mean, every hole feels like the end of the world. And, you know, every shot you hit is a chance to make 40, 50, 60,000 people go crazy.
Yeah.
So it's a rare opportunity. And I'm a little bit, I don't think I'm really surprised because it was very important to me. I wanted to play well. And, you know, as things started to go well, I think it was just easy for me to kind of dive into the atmosphere a little bit more so maybe than I expected, but I'm not entirely surprised.
Yeah. So you really dove into the atmosphere so much that on the seventh hole, JT tells me this story that you were trying to figure out, hey, did Trump end up coming out today? He's like, dude, we walk right past him to the tee. You didn't see him? It's like, no, I must have blacked out.
I was just getting to the tee. I had one job. I had to get from the tunnel to the tee. And I never saw him. I knew he was going to be, I don't even know what I was talking about. I knew he was going to be there. I was just moving my mouth so my brain would stop working. But yeah, I guess he was there. And but I was focused on other things.
Yeah, I imagine so. And you guys, I mean, y'all put a butt whipping on some guys in the afternoon with JT and Bryson. So when Keegan tells everybody the assignment for Sunday and when everybody's going out, did he tell you in advance that that he was going to send you off first in singles? Because that's one of the biggest roles that most of the time captains will tell a player. It's like, hey, man, I'm counting on you on that first match. Did you have a conversation with Keegs?
No. I mean, the only conversation really throughout the week was just that I felt good. And I was up for whatever he wanted for me. So I felt like it was up to him to make the decisions for what he thought was best. And whether he put me first or last, I was, you know, happy to go try to do my job that I was given. So yeah, when it comes out, I mean, obviously Justin Rose has a tremendous Ryder Cup record. He's playing some of the best golf of his career. And Yeah. I mean, you kind of just know what you're going to get. I've obviously never played a Ryder Cup singles, but I've seen enough and, know him as a player. So I kind of knew what I was going to get. And it was kind of a rollercoaster round, but
I didn't miss a shot. I was walking with you the entire day. So I want to take you to the 13th hole because you're in control of this match really until 13. And then he hits it down the cliff on that par five. And if you've ever played at Bethpage and you're playing a match in match play, that's a win. You're going to win that hole if somebody hits it down that cliff. So you're already in good position putting for birdie. And we waited and we waited and we waited some more, waiting for this ruling for Justin Rose to try to figure out what the heck was going to happen. We end up potentially going to 14T where he's going to drop it. And it just took forever. And then Keegan comes running up. He's like, we got to get this thing going. We got to get this thing going. It was just chaos, man. And then he hits the shot and you're just like, what the hell just happened?
It's one of those times. It was a long enough time that Justin Thomas and the group behind me came up and hung out for like 5 full minutes before he walked back to go hit his wedge shot. So they caught up to us. They waited for a long time. He came up. Literally, we sat and like chatted on the back of the green for 5 minutes and then he went back. So it was about the longest I've ever waited to hit a putt. But it's one of those times I was so shocked he hit it down there. It's just not what you expect. I mean, I kind of had been all over the place. I think I was in the bunker and laid it up in the rough and then hit a wedge pretty close. But I was so shocked he hit it down there that you're just kind of waiting for something stupid to happen.
That was something stupid. The ball maybe got about this high off of like the top of the hill, like from a height perspective.
Yeah.
Landed low into the rough and then spun.
Spins left and back. Yeah. No, it was, I would put it right up there with one of the best shots I've ever seen in my life. Never mind given the circumstances, staring at kind of going four down. And then all of a sudden, I roll it over the low lip and he makes it and then makes it 15 footer on the next hole and I miss a short one. All of a sudden I'm one up where I thought I was going to be four and potentially ending my match before I got across that road. So that definitely changed the dynamic of the match. And looking back, I don't feel that I was particularly rattled by it. It just, I happened to miss two, a 6 footer and an 8 footer back to back. And he did what good players do.
So it was
a much less fun hour after that or half an hour after that than it had been before.
You didn't want to give him that driver wrench on the 15 tee?
No. I didn't.
That was a little surprising, huh?
I don't know. I feel like there's always a little bit of gamesmanship and I don't know how much of that was that versus needing it. But I don't think we were the two people to ask in that moment.
No, definitely not coming off of what just happened at 13 and 14. All right. So, you had this potential to be like four up through 13 holes. Now you're at 18, you're all tied and you know how important this match is. Like a half barely does you anything. You have to win this match and you get up there and I couldn't tell if you didn't like your second shot or not. I'm up at the green. You're like, I didn't know what to think. Did you think you'd like miss the green left or long?
I thought it might be long. I knew directionally it was fine. If the distance was good, I figured it would maybe be near the fringe, which it was.
Yeah.
But I thought there was a chance it could have skipped up into the rough, which would have been
not great,
devastating. Because you just never know. If it gets a foot in the rough, it's fine. If it gets 6 feet in the rough, you're kind of in a bad spot.
Yeah.
So it's so uncertain from down there. I mean, you can't feel the wind over the stands.
No.
That shot seems to just play long for whatever reason. I think it was just the wind does come that way and you can't feel it. It's a pretty dramatic, uphill slope to the green and then trying to hit something low. It can be hard to control your distance, especially under those circumstances. And I thought I might have hit it too far.
Okay. So I couldn't quite reaction. Tell. I'm like, it's one of those, I'm watching left, your body language. Yeah. I'm watching up there. And so Justin misses and gives you the opportunity to have that putt, you were talking about earlier, to go and win something big. I mean, how tough was it to not get ahead of yourself? And did you know you were going to make it?
Yeah. I didn't know I was going to make it. I felt like I had a good read and I felt like I was in a position to hit a good putt. So it was just kind of up to what happened. But it kind of hit me when he was set up over the ball. I was pretty sure he was not close with his read. I remember him setting up and I was like, that's usually he's all day. It's looked like it's going to go in.
Yeah.
And that one just didn't to me. Sometimes just from a different angle, you can kind of tell. It was one of those, I was kind of disbelieved. I was like, either I'm nuts or that's not going in and I'm going to have a putt to win this match.
Yeah.
So it kind of started to sit in there just, and then you know, he does end up missing like a cup left and, all of a sudden it's a match that I felt like was over positively. And then I felt like was over kind of the other way. And all of a sudden I've got a putt to win. And, you know, it's a rare opportunity. You don't get many of those. So I was going to do everything I could to hit a good putt. You know,
yeah. Imagine a full circle moment, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously I would have loved nothing. I would have done anything for that. The ball to go in the hole. But all I could do was hit a good putt. And, I feel like I did a really good job of just settling in and making a stroke. And kind of when I looked up about halfway there, it looked good. So I wasn't ready to celebrate early, but I thought it was going to go in pretty early and, you know, waited for it to actually hit the back of the hole before I did anything. But that was cool. I mean, I couldn't have asked for, you know, you may never bet that butt again.
And, yeah.
To have made the one that I had is pretty cool.
I'm laughing, you know, the story that you talk about walking through the tunnel to the first tee and just mm-hmm. kind of blacking out, just making sure I just got to get to the tee. Well, after you made that putt, I was watching it last night and I think you dropped the ball like three or four different times trying to get it into your pocket.
Yeah. I don't know why. Again, I should have let Kyle go get it.
Yeah, what just at that point, you're like, just leave it on the ground.
No, I couldn't even see. Yeah, It's one of those times I'd like for that clip to disappear, but that's
okay. Honestly, we were far enough
I was getting
back,
out of the hole and I wasn't picking it up off the ground.
I saw you initially drop it once, but then we cut to a crowd shot, but we could still see, mm-hmm. I could still see you. I was like, man, he's still trying to pick up the ball. I just watched it last night.
I think it was three at least. But the coordination ended as soon as the ball went in.
Okay, but then another really cool hug besides your family was the warm embrace that you got from the assistant captain, Webb Simpson, a player that played at Wake Forest, I'm sure is whether it be a mentor, almost like a big brother to you. How cool was it to kind of have that embrace with a guy like Webb off that 18th tee, who was walking with you step for step that day?
Yeah, I mean, he's the best. He was obviously with the Wake Forest connection and share an agent. And he was an immediate connection as soon as I got out on tour. And you know, when I first came out, he was a number four player in the world, maybe mm-hmm. 4 years ago, 5 years ago at most. So he was a huge influence on me, just kind of how to go about professional golf on the PGA Tour, and to kind of get to do that with him was really special. I mean, he's a great man. And I just remember he said to me, gave him a big hug and then he said, I can't even look at you. I'm going to cry. And I was like, I might too. And, so he kind of ran away after that. And I don't think anyone wanted to see either of us crying out there. So it's a cool moment. I mean, he's a great person and he's been nothing but amazing to me. So to kind of have that shared memory is really cool.
Man, you need to get like a cool painting or something from that 18th green because you've had some damn good memories on that green, making a putt in that first match and on Sunday singles. And also, I know how important the New York State Open is for anybody that lives up in New York and winning that as an amateur in a playoff hole, making a birdie on that hole as well. Which, by the way, how long was that putt for birdie in that playoff hole?
It was short. It was maybe 5 or 6 feet. And I think
it would have been a good opportunity for you to say hole. Like, it would have been a good opportunity for you to be like, 25 feet. You know, this thing could keep stretching. Yeah. Like, you know.
Yeah, it could. It could. No, I don't want to embellish it. It was a short one.
Well, man, before we get to the emergency nine with Charlie, there's one last thing that I'd like for you to speak upon, which is the Cam Young, Justin Thomas, South Florida PGA Junior Tour Challenge Cup. It's a very, very long name, but also it's for a great cause. There was so much that happened at the Ryder Cup, whether you think it was good or bad with the fans and this and that. Mm-hmm. But you guys, you know, using some of your money from the Ryder Cup to go and support something that hits home to both you and Justin, having fathers, the PGA of America, and giving back to junior golf. Just tell me about How excited are you for this event, and how excited are you to captain and potentially take down JT?
Yeah, I would love to take him down. Yeah, we're both excited about it. Like you said, we both grew up as sons of PGA professionals, and you know, I grew up playing those local section events. So for us to be able to do something, you know, with the money they give us to do some charity, it's something that I don't think many people have really done. I mean, so many of us live down in South Florida, and there's just not a big enough kind of presence to me down there among all the guys that live there. And I think it's just a nice opportunity to start something. You know, I think it'll be a fun event. You know, that style event is always fun.
Sure.
And to get to do it with him and kind of hopefully start, you know, the beginnings of something more to come of that, you know, with more players involved, and just to, you know, help that section and make it what it can be, everything it can be, will be a great opportunity for us.
That's super exciting, man. Can't wait to hear about it. And especially the back and forth between you and JT and who ends up being the first inaugural captain winner. Yeah. All right, Charlie, hop back on here. Let's rip some E9, buddy.
We are on location at the PGA show for this, which I'm realizing is very topical given Cam's connection as his dad is a PGA pro. So this is all working together. The E9, the emergency nine, it's of course when 18 holes just isn't enough, got to sneak in another quick nine. And of course, this is what we're doing here, Cam. Nine quick questions, lightning round to close this interview out. Here's where we're going to start with the first question is better home course, Old Town for Wake Forest, which is of course an amazing venue, or I've heard Fordham Prep, your high school, you used Winged Foot for a few home matches. So Winged Foot or Old
Either
Town?
Winged Foot or Pelham Bay. man, they're both good. I Winged Foot is really hard to top. I mean, major championship venue, I feel like you got to give them out there.
Okay, Winged Foot, good answer. As much as I love Old Town. All right, number two.
So do I.
Give me your medal podium, bronze, silver, gold, for all-time Wake Forest golfers.
Man.
Ooh, that's tough.
There's a lot of good in there.
I mean, Arnold Palmer and, Lanny Watkins was so good. Bill Haas was so good. Webb was so good. I feel like it's a really hard one. I mean, Bill's a FedEx Cup champion. Webb's a major winner. Lanny Watkins played 8 Ryder Cups. And Arnold Palmer was Arnold Palmer. So I don't know if I can put 3 up there. I feel like Arnold's definitely on there.
We could convert it to a Mount Rushmore for you. You just gave us 4 with a car. There we
five,
go.
And then maybe Will and I can try to battle it out for 6th. But there's a ton. I mean, there's so many good players that have gone.
Okay.
Happy to be kind of continuing that legacy.
That works there. All right. So now for number 3, we're going to go to what sort of scouting report will we get from your father-in-law on Cam Young, the youth hockey player?
The youth hockey player.
Has he coached you, correct? Do I have that right?
He did, yeah. Yeah, he did. I was always a pretty good direction follower. I followed. I didn't like breaking the rules. I didn't like getting penalties. So I feel like I definitely didn't cause too many problems. I don't know. I don't know if it would. I think it would have been positive overall. Positive overall, and maybe not the highest talent, but you know, I was willing to follow directions and kind of listen, maybe more than most kids at 12 years old would have.
Right, were you slapping draws? Release? Were you slapping draws?
Yeah, I was frying.
Okay, very good. All right, so number 4, which golf course have you not played that you most want to play?
Wow. Gosh, that's a hard one. You know, one of the ones out on the West Coast, I've never been to Bandon Dunes. You know, I know that I just hosted a USA in there, I think 2 years ago. I watched a little bit of that. I mean, there's so many. That just strikes me as a really cool piece of property and a style that I like. So I'd love to get out there at some point, but there's really too many to pick one.
I like that. Get the boys together for a little trip out to Bandon Dunes.
Yeah, there you go.
Number 5 here, Smiley mentioned off the top of the show, we're both fathers of 2 here on the Smiley Show. You're, of course, a father of 3. So first of all, congrats. Second of all, please send us tips if you have them. What is your favorite non-golf activity to do with your kids when you're not on the road?
A couple things. They both love riding bikes. my 3-year-old just magically kind of figured it out on his own pretty recently. He's been watching his older brother for the last 6 months or so learn, and I think just by osmosis, one day he woke up and he could ride a bike. So doing that with them is a lot of fun. And then at home in Florida, a lot of our days end up consisting of catching lizards. especially my oldest. He's getting pretty good, honestly. He's probably got a higher hit rate than I do, but
they're everywhere.
I think they know he's coming, though. Sometimes it's harder to find him around our house.
All right, lizards advice. That's a pretty good little combo there, and we're gonna stay on this theme for a few questions here, because number six, I was watching a video last year during your practice round at the Genesis, and I don't know if it was Henry or John, but one of the two of them was rocking an incredible pair of cowboy boots. I just want to know if you have a matching pair. Like, do we have cowboy boots for the whole family? Just okay. All right.
No, I wish. He looks good in those. He at the time he had a pretty good mullet going in the cowboy boots. that's a staple in our house for sure. They've actually got matching pairs right now, so the two of them will go out there.
Love that. You know,
dressed in whatever else, and kind of get themselves all muddy.
Fantastic vibe. Okay, so number seven. Last year at the Masters, I remember Rory sitting up at the podium heading into the final round. Maybe it was after a Saturday round, talking about watching Zootopia with Poppy before the final round. And so we will admit from time to time on the show, the movies which we pretend like we're watching for the kids, we really enjoy them. And I want to know if you have like a movie or two that you secretly enjoy watching with the kids.
Yeah, you know, we've tried really hard not to let them watch much. But the one thing that they watched a decent bit of was last year in Hawaii. We basically had one hotel room for all five of us. So we were trying to find stuff to do at night, and we watched the better part of the entirety of Planet Earth in that week.
Yes.
And just because we felt like it kind of wasn't as stimulating. It's a little bit more relaxed, and trying to get them just to fall asleep without fighting us. And it's great. I think it's really entertaining. And they were just at ages where it's falling, and they're excited. They think that whales are fish, then they just shout fish and bird and whatever. So it's entertaining for everybody.
We're a big Blue Planet household. So I like that. I like that a lot. Yeah. It's a great vibe.
I turn on Beauty and the Beast for just fun now, you know.
It's Red to the Dead. They love the Disney books. It's crazy. And they're a little too long for me. It's 100 pages. Stretches the limits of my reading, but they love that kind of stuff.
All right, so number eight. My 3-year-old Walker loves playing golf, but wants nothing to do with my swing tips. And so, knowing that your dad was a pro, right? I want to know. Go back to your childhood. The swing tip your dad gave you as a kid that you least wanted to hear.
Oh, for sure. He always wanted my right leg. I used to kind of sway out onto the outside of my right leg a lot. Mm-hmm. And I always just felt like from there I could hit it farther. And he said, no, if you like make that right leg really solid to where you never get outside of it on the outside part of the foot, it's going to be more consistent and you're going to hit it harder. And I hated practicing that.
Trying to drop bombs, Dad.
I was. But fantastic. That one really has stuck with me.
Okay, the ninth and final of the E9 here, Cam. I got some intel here that you're quite the chef. Okay, so we're on some big cooking show, okay? And we need you to whip up your best dish. What are you making?
Best? Man. I don't know where you got that intel from. It's really unimpressive. I make a lot of fried rice, really simple, just like rice, beef, eggs, onions, that kind of thing. If I had to make something, make a decent like creamy pesto sauce for some pasta and a steak. That's one of my favorite things. I don't make it often, but it's pretty good.
I'm good at reheating nuggets, so you're a lot further along than I am. So That is the E9, Cam. You're good to take the time to do it. Smile, let's wrap this thing up.
Thank you. Actually, the match was tied after 9 holes. I have a bonus question.
What's
your favorite hole at Sleepy Hollow? I just need to have that in my brain here.
There's a few. The redesign of number 8, I think, is really cool. I love 8.
Is that the par 3 down the hill?
No, that's 10. It's now like a 500 yard hole, and it's kind of got a green that goes around a bunker and has that like left tier to it.
Yes.
That's a really cool hole. I really like what they did with 14 on those big humps through the middle. 16 is, I mean, they won the prettiest holes in the world. So that's up there too. It's hard to pick one, but I mean, from a golf standpoint, maybe 8, and from a view standpoint, 16 is unmatched.
What's the par 5 Dahlweg right around the corner where you can hit it on top of that 6 tier? Okay. Was that the hole that you got outside your brace on to try to hit it on top of the wedge there? Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. Big healer into the woods is my, that was my classic one.
Well, I got that shot too. I still got that shot today, Cam. Man, this has been awesome. Quick update. Where are you playing coming up so we know where to look out for you?
Yeah, I'm playing next week at the Farmers in San Diego. I'm actually starting 4 in a row. So I'm going to play Farmers, Phoenix, Pebble, and LA.
All right, buddy. Well, Cam, this has been a great conversation. So fun to look back all the way back to when you turned pro and to where you are now. So much has happened and so much that's been so good. So thank you for taking the time today. It's been a lot of fun. Look forward to reading you on here in the next 4 weeks.
You know, I listen to this podcast. It's really cool. And
all of our lovely fans and subscribers, but make sure you like and subscribe.
It's cool to see what you guys are doing. I know golf fans appreciate it, but we do too. So please keep it up.
For all the good people on YouTube, like and subscribe.
You guys have some good takes. So I'm happy to come on and shoot the